And the work involves a number of collaborators, some of whom I've listed here. Includes Ed Brown, Michigan State, Kai Hebler from Ohio State, Danny Paj from Mexico, Chris Pethick at Nordita, Prakash from Ohio University, Occam Schwenk at Darmstadt, Andrew Steiner at MSU, and I neglected to put Yun Wan Lim, who's a graduate student at Stony Brook. So the topics I'd like to focus on are recent measurements of masses, and we'll look in particular at the measurement of a two-solar mass neutron star and the implications that that has for aspects of the equation of state. And we'll also look at some interesting limits to the extent of quark matter that are implied by a two-solar mass neutron star. In addition, there is evidence of even larger neutron star masses, and I will briefly summarize some of that work. There's also been some developments concerning observations of neutron star radii. In contrast to masses, where we have more rather accurate measurements, the radii are less well constrained. The observations, the interpretation of the observations are model dependent. Nevertheless, they've been recently used with some to develop some interesting results concerning the constraints on the nuclear symmetry energy and what that implies for the radii of neutron stars. And in addition, there are interesting constraints on the maximum masses of neutron stars that can be established from those radius observations. And so that takes us to the third topic here, which is the development of a universal mass-radius relation that would be consistent with the available observations and the resulting equation of state. And then we'll want to look at how consistent this is with, for example, looking at neutron matter expectations and also other laboratory constraints, such as binding energies. And then if there's any time permitting, I would like to briefly discuss some aspects of the evolution of neutron stars and how that impacts our understanding of the equation of state, including the recent observations of rapid cooling of CAS A, which we think can be most easily interpreted in terms of the onset of neutron superfluidity in the core of the star. So from the equation of state to neutron star structure, or vice versa, is a relatively straightforward process. We have the relativistic structure equations. The denominator term in the hydrostatic equilibrium equation implies the existence of a maximum mass. This is something that would not occur in Newtonian gravity. And so the idea is that once you pick a central pressure and energy density and integrate the structure equations from there to the surface of the star, the only quantities you need are the way in which energy and energy density and pressure vary with each other. And once this integration is done, it results in a particular mass and radius point. And as we increase the central pressure, we'll reach the maximum mass point, and stars with higher central densities or pressures are dynamically unstable. So the first and important aspect of the mass-radius relationship that follows from these integrations are, first of all, the existence of a maximum mass. So that's a very important observable, and that will certainly set very important constraints for the underlying equation of state. And secondly is the existence of a relatively vertical region, especially since the maximum mass is now known to be relatively large. This relatively vertical portion of the mass radius diagram, implying a rather constant radius for masses in the range of 1 to 1.5 solar masses, that's the second important observable that will constrain the equation of state. Corondis, Stergiulis, and Friedman carried out a thought experiment in which they wanted to explore the limits, extreme limits for neutron stars, especially in terms of compactness. And the exercises, they hypothesized that the smallest, most compact configurations would be found if, at low densities, the equation of state was relatively soft. In other words, small pressure is a function of energy density. And at high energy densities, the pressure would be correspondingly as stiff as possible. And that stiffness limit is given by the causal limit. So the natural extremization of this process involves having zero pressure up to a fiducial energy density, epsilon naught. And above that energy density, the pressure increases linearly with energy density so that the speed of sound and the speed of light are equal. Then we find that we can scale the TOV equations by substitutions of appropriate powers of the this fiducial energy density. So, for example, the maximum mass of this equation of state can be found, and it will scale with this particular factor. So we can establish a number of results that are dependent only upon the assumption of causality and general relativity. And among them are the Rhodes and Ruffini result for the maximum mass, which is about 4 solar masses if that fiducial energy density is equal to the nuclear saturation energy density. Just for future reference, the saturation energy density is about 150 MeV per cubic Fermi. That's equivalent to about 0.16 Fermis, baryons per cubic Fermi, or about 2.5 to 3 × 10^14 grams per cubic centimeter. This gravitational mass limit is equivalent to this baryon mass limit of about 5.4 solar masses. The maximum mass is reached when the radius has a value that's about 2.8 times gm over c squared in this maximally compact equation of state. So that sets an absolute minimum to the radius of a given mass configuration. So that works out to be about 4 kilometers, 4.3 kilometers for each solar mass. The a result that does not depend on the fiducial energy density is that the baryon chemical potential cannot exceed about 2.1 GeV. The central energy density can't exceed about 3 times this fiducial energy density. And when we use this limit together with the first constraint on mass, we find that this corresponds to an energy density of about 51 times the nuclear saturation energy density divided by the square of the largest measured neutron star mass. So this gives somewhat the a paradoxical result that the largest mass neutron star we measure sets an upper limit to the energy density of any neutron star, because any other neutron star can only have a lower mass and therefore a lower central energy density. On the other hand, if we discover a neutron star with a higher mass than the current limit, then that pushes the upper limit to the energy density of every neutron star down even further. The same thing happens for the pressure. It also scales with the inverse of the largest measured mass. And in units of the saturation energy density, it's about 34. For the coefficient for the baryon density, that limit is about 38 times the nuclear saturation baryon density. And for the most compact configuration, at the maximum mass, the binding energy is extremized, and it has a value of about 33% of the gravitational mass. And finally, the scaling of the TOV equations continue into axis symmetry. And as a result, one can determine, again, a model-independent, equation of state-independent, only dependent on the assumption of causality, limit to the rotation period, and the smallest rotation period is about 0.75 milliseconds for a star that, when it was not rotating, had a gravitational mass of 1 solar mass and a radius of 10 kilometers. So this limit is a general one that we can take the star non-spinning and measure its mass and radius, and then determine the minimum spin period for that configuration at the point where if it's uniformly rotating, where at the mass shedding limit. And if we use the radius constraint here, 2.8 gm over c squared, this corresponds to 0.2 milliseconds for a one solar mass configuration. So to put the energy density maximum mass relation in a little bit more visual context, Prakash and I assembled the results of several different kinds of equations of state, including non-relativistic potential models like Skirm forces. Relativistic field theoretical models are shown by the diamonds, green diamonds. Stars with appreciable amounts of quarks, either as pure quark stars or as hybrid stars, are shown as the red triangles. And stars that have appreciable numbers of hyperons or kaons in their interiors are shown as the purple squares. And all of these configurations, the points indicate the central energy density at the and the maximum mass for those particular equations of state. Of course, I could have colored, completely filled the diagram with points, but I've tried to be selective here. The maximally compact limit with the speed of sound equal to the speed of light, s equals 1 in this relation, gives the curve that's shown here. And a couple of the non-relativistic models do seem to violate that limit, but that's because they become acausal just before the maximum mass point is reached. So this limit basically holds for all equations of state. And what's also interesting on this picture is that ultimately, at high densities, we believe that quark matter in the limit of asymptotic freedom, the limiting pressure-energy density relation, would be such that the speed of sound would be the square root of one-third the speed of light. So if we redo the TOV, dimensionless TOV equation with a factor of one-third in here, again, energy density, this fiducial energy density is the only parameter of the equation of state that appears, and we get a different relation between the energy density, central energy density, and maximum mass of those stars. And we can see that for all of the quark matter stars, that that represents a realistic limit in that context as well. And in fact, we've explored this further for a much wider number of quark matter equations of state. And the general result is that any star that has quarks in the star, whether it's a very small core of a hybrid star with quark mat with a mixed phase of quarks and hadrons at the center, or whether it's a pure quark star, they all basically satisfy this lowered limit on the energy density as a function of maximum as a function of maximum mass. And the ratio between this curve and this curve is about a factor of 2 or 1.5 to 2, something like that. So it's what this implies is that if we believe that there is a transition to quark matter at high densities, that the this must happen at relatively low densities. Because with a two solar mass upper limit, this basically says that a star with quarks at the center can't have a central baryon density much greater than 5 or 6, which is surprisingly low. And so that's with current mass limits. If a 2.4 solar mass star, as I will argue, might have been seen, then this limit is pushed down to 4 or so. So the equations of state in a traditional mass radius diagram, the hadronic equations of state are shown in black. Pure quark matter equations of state are shown as green curves. Here we see the typical result of a practically vertical portion of many of these mass radius curves, especially if the maximum mass is predicted by these equations of state is greater than about 2 solar masses. So equations of state like GS1 and PAL6 are not realistic models any longer because they can't satisfy the mass constraints. The boundary that's shown here as the green-gray boundary is basically the limit to the radius of a neutron star that's spinning at the fastest rate observed for a pulsar, 716 hertz. And that's the pulsar J1748. So for that particular star, the mass and radius have to lie in this gray region and not in the green region. There were reports a few years ago of a spin frequency observed from an X-ray source, XTE J1739, about 1.1, I guess it's about 1100 hertz. And if that, in fact, turned out to be true, although the results are disputed because the observations are not reproducible, but if that did turn out to be the case, then this boundary here would be moved to this red dashed line. And so that would be quite a significant constraint on that particular object. So the current masses are summarized here. The measurements from pulsar X-ray timing are shown in the three lower regions, the gold, silver, and blue regions. The result for those pulsar timing measurements, which involve double neutron star systems, consistently show relatively small neutron star masses, clustered around 1.35 to 1.4 solar masses. Those neutron stars with white dwarf companions seem to show a much larger scatter in masses, although it's interesting that the error-weighted mean mass of the white dwarf neutron star binaries shown by this dashed line is actually a little bit smaller than the mean error-weighted masses of the double neutron star binaries. So only a few of these white dwarf neutron star binaries have very tight mass constraints. And the largest mass so far is the one with about 0.04 solar mass to one sigma measurement at 1.97 solar masses of the reported by DeMorest et al. For the pulsar J1614. And I'll talk about that a little bit more. Previous to that, the maximum mass for a well-constrained neutron star was about 1.67 solar masses for J1903, with a 1/100th of a solar mass, one sigma uncertainty, by Champion et al. In 2008. The upper region shows mass measurements estimated from X-ray systems, including some systems with pulsars. And again, there's a wide spread in masses. The error bars are consistently quite large because of systematics. There's a great amount of model dependence in how these systems are analyzed. A lot depends on the shape of the binary and the interpretation of the optical light curve, which is in some cases not very well determined. And the case that I want to spend a little bit of time on is the so-called Black Widow pulsar that has a mean measured mass of about 2.4 solar masses. And if that one was confirmed at that level, that would be extremely interesting from the equation of state perspective. So the two solar mass neutron star discovered by DeMorest et al. Is an interesting case. This is a case where Shapiro time delay basically tightly constrains the inclination angle. And the Shapiro time delay in the system is extraordinarily large for a pulsar system because it's almost perfectly edge-on. So the sine of the inclination angle is 1 to within a couple parts in 10,000. As a result, the Shapiro time delay, which comes from the fact that the signal from the pulsar has to pass through the gravitational well of the companion on its way to the observer, depending on the position of the pulsar relative to the companion, that time delay can be relatively large, or in other cases, when the pulsar is on the opposite side of the companion, the signal still has to climb out of the gravitational well of the companion, but much less so. So in this system, there's about a 50 microsecond change in the timing delay when the pulsar is on the near side compared to being on the far side of the orbit. And so the magnitude of this delay, together with the shape of the delay curve, tightly constrains the inclination angle in the system. And allows a determination of the mass to a few parts in to a few percent. And further observations of the system should constrain the shape of this time delay pattern even further and result in a further reduction of the of the mass errors. So the system seems to be well under control, and in comparison to other pulsar timing measurements with estimated large neutron star masses such as these, which do not have measured inclination angles, it's much more believable. You'll notice this system, J1909, the 2.95 millisecond pulsar, that also had an initial mass estimate of in the neighborhood of 2 to 2.5 solar masses, again, without a measured inclination angle. So the error bars and the centroid values were simply determined by the most, by statistics of one, so to speak. And once the inclination angle of the system was measured by Shapiro time delay, again, the mass was greatly reduced. So we just have to wait to see what happens with these two particular objects. The Black Widow pulsar is a case in which the name is connected with the fact that the pulsar seems to be, in a sense, devouring its companion, although most of the mass of the companion is actually being ejected from the system and not being swallowed by the neutron star. But it's a 1.6 millisecond pulsar in a nearly circular 9-hour orbit with a very, very small 0.03 solar mass companion. So the companion is visible in visible light, but it's not a normal star. It's not producing energy by nuclear burning because its mass is a factor of 3 too small. It's illuminated by the pulsar, and so we're seeing the heated material on the side of the star that's closest to the pulsar as it orbits the pulsar. The pulsar itself is eclipsed for a significant fraction of the orbit, about 10%, 50 or 60 minutes. And this implies that the eclipsing object has an extremely large radius, much larger than the size of the companion, and much larger than the Roche lobe of the companion. So it's believed that there's a cloud of material being evaporated from this small star by the heating of the due to the pulsar. And most of this mass is being blown away, but as the system orbits, the pulsar becomes invisible for about an hour during that period. So it's also believed that from fitting the shapes of the fitting the radial velocity and the optical light curve, that the companion must be nearly filling its Roche lobe. We get some indication of the size of the companion and the shape of the companion from the variation of the optical light seen as the companion orbits the neutron star. But an interesting feature here is that if the companion, in fact, was a point source, the pulsar would be determined to have a mass of about 1.6 solar masses. So this represents actually a absolute lower limit to the mass of this pulsar. In fact, and if the companion is entirely filling its Roche lobe, the mass of the companion must be 2.8 solar masses. So the result, right result is somewhere in between, and it's model dependent in the sense of trying to best fit a model of the shape of the companion with the observations. So this work is still continuing, and there's hope that some reduction in the error will be produced by better modeling of this system. The point is that the optical light curve doesn't represent the motion of the center of mass of the companion, but rather the so-called center of light of the companion, which is that point on the surface of the star that's closest to the pulsar. And that's what we see, that's what we observe moving around the pulsar, not the center of mass as would typically be observed. So the implications, then, are summarized here if the maximum mass of a neutron star is either two solar masses or 2.4 solar masses based on the Karan-Justera-Giulis and Friedman maximally compact results. So the energy density in the two solar mass case is limited to basically 13 times the nuclear saturation energy density, the pressure to about 9 times that value, and the baryon density to about 10 times the saturation energy number density. In the case of a 2.4 solar mass upper limit, then these quantities are respectively reduced by about a factor of one-third, so that they're about two-thirds of the previous result. The lower limit to the spin period in this case is a half a millisecond, and in this case would be about two-thirds of a millisecond. The lower limit to neutron star radius in this case is 8.5 kilometers. In this case, it's about 10.4 kilometers. So these lower limits to the neutron star radius are for hadronic equations of state, not for pure quark matter equations of state. And in the case that there's a quark matter core, then the upper limits to the energy density, pressure, and baryon density are significantly reduced from those in which the center of the star is hadronic. And again, there's a factor of one-third reduction in the results going from S equals, two solar mass upper limit to 2.4 solar mass upper limit. So this case is very interesting because in a case of a 2.4 solar mass star, the limit to the baryon density is less than 5 times the baryon density at saturation. Yes?
From this?
No. Well, I mean, I guess it would have to be this density, right? So what we've tried to do is check it for equations of state in which the quark matter will come in before the maximum mass is reached. So even if it turns out that that only 1% or 5% of the star is quark matter, that this S equals one-third limit is more or less accurate. So these basically represent those numbers. The densities are related to these particular limits. Now, this wasn't the main theme I wanted to talk about, but for the discussion on supernova modeling, there's an interesting problem waiting to be uncovered, or a solution waiting to be found, as you will. A number of neutron stars are observed that have relatively low masses. And again, there's model dependence in the determination of these masses, but situation is becoming interesting. So recent refined mass determinations of several X-ray pulsar binaries by Rolls, Arras, McClintock, and Torres for these particular objects are shown here, and for a number of them, like 4U1538, SMC-X1, and Hercules-X1, the maximum masses, the masses of the pulsars, of the neutron stars, are extremely small, in the neighborhood of about one solar mass. Now, the error bars are quite large, except in this case, but again, that's just a one sigma error, and I don't know how much systematics have been included in these determinations, so all of these should be taken right now with a grain of salt. But it is still interesting, and that's because the current paradigm for the production of neutron stars requires that the neutron stars pass through a proto-neutron star phase. This is obvious from the point of view that we believe that the supernova mechanism, except possibly in the case of the very lowest mass progenitors, relies on the extra energy that's input into the configuration half a second to a second after the explosion by neutrinos. So there must be a source of neutrinos, a proto-neutron star, and the observation of 87A certainly indicated that the proto-neutron star existed for a period of several seconds at least. And in that case, proto-neutron star to have sufficient neutrino luminosity is going to have to have a fairly high lepton fraction in the center. Typical models indicate somewhere between 30 and 40% for that. The unshocked inner core has an entropy of about 1, and in the region outside of about 0.7 or 0.8 solar masses from the center, the entropy is increased by the shock wave that's produced at the edge of the infalling iron core to values of at least 4 or 5 and probably much greater than that. So this shows the results of TOV integrations for a protoneutron star mass radius diagram, and for a protoneutron star with that kind of for those kinds of parameters, we see that the minimum mass of these configurations turns out to be in the neighborhood of 1 solar mass. Compare that to the case for a cold catalyzed neutron star, which is shown here, T equals 0 result, for which the minimum mass is about 0.08 or 0.09 solar masses. So given these minimum masses, the protoneutron star paradigm requires that a neutron star can't be formed with less than a solar mass. Now, that number, again, has some play to it of probably a couple of tenths of a solar mass, but it's becoming dangerously close to these small masses that are measured in these X-ray systems. So I just bring this up as something to keep an eye on in the future, and maybe it might be necessary at some point to develop alternate neutron star formation mechanisms, possibly involving magnetic fields or rotation or something else, to solve this situation, if it turns out to be a situation. So the result that the radius of a neutron star is an important measure of the equation of state is indicated by, if we look, for example, at how the pressure of different equations of state, of which a variety are indicated here, vary with baryon density, we find that the pressure basically varies as a quadratic, as a square of the energy density. The slopes of these curves are all pretty similar. And if we use Newtonian gravity, the polytropic relation with pressure varying like density squared suggests that the radius basically will become independent of the mass, more or less what's observed for intermediate mass neutron stars. In addition, it predicts that the dependence on the equation of state at some fiducial point varies as the square root of the underlying pressure. So this suggests that the pressure of some intermediate density can be determined by measuring the radius of a star, since it's relatively insensitive to the mass. And these equations of state at nuclear saturation density have a total range of pressures of about a factor of 6. So this accounts for the wide variety in the radii of equations of state that are predicted by these equations of state, ranging from about 9 kilometers in the case of the brown one to almost 16 kilometers for the Ponderup-Pondé-Smith equation of state, which is this chartreuse one at the top, which has the highest pressure at the nuclear saturation density. Prakash and I wanted to test this relationship, and we found that, in fact, the radius varies as a much smaller power of pressure. But the point is that the measurement of the radius of a star will then give us a handy measurement of the overall pressure. So as we know, the pressure around nuclear saturation density is determined by the symmetry energy. I don't have time to go through this in detail, but basically the symmetry energy is around 30 MeV from mass fits, and the density dependence of this is what determines the pressure at around the nuclear saturation density. One point I do want to bring up is that there is a difference between the so-called symmetry energy and the coefficient in a droplet model fit to nuclear masses. Basically, this symmetry energy coefficient is the second derivative of the energy with respect to proton fraction at x equals 1/2, while E sim is basically the difference between the energy at nuclear density of neutron matter and symmetric matter. And these numbers can be different by 4 or 5 MeV for a typical equation of state. And correspondingly, the derivatives of these quantities, the derivative of SV or the derivative of Vsim, can also be substantially different as well. So one should not confuse one with the other. We can get some control over what's happening by looking at mass fits, which determine that there is a correlation between the energy of matter and the pressure of matter, or the symmetry energy and its derivative. If you take a liquid droplet mass formula and simply fit it to nuclear masses, you find that there's a nice linear correlation between the ratio of the surface symmetry coefficient and the volume symmetry coefficient relative to the volume symmetry coefficient. Typical mass formulas like the Molar-Nix mass formula give a value that's right on this correlation line. The point is that as we move along this correlation line, the fits to nuclei do not suffer very much. So nuclear masses do not overall constrain the symmetry energies, only give us this very tight correlation. Okay, I'm going to skip through this a little bit because there's another point I wanted to make at the end. Basically, we can use radius measurements from measuring cooling neutron stars and by looking at photospheric radius expansion bursts. From looking at thermal sources, we basically can establish a measurement of the quantity that's known as R infinity, which is a redshifted radius, since the flux and the temperature observed from thermal sources are both redshifted quantities. The radius, or the angular area of a source we would measure, is also redshifted. And these show typical error bars, error regions, obtained neutron stars, some neutron stars. In addition, photospheric radius expansion bursts can use the relationships that the maximum observed flux observed from these sources, it will be close to the so-called Eddington limit, which is basically related to the maximum luminosity that a source can have and without blowing the surface completely off, is basically given by the balance between radiation pressure and gravity. That depends only on the mass of the source and of the underlying source and the opacity. Since it's a flux, we also have an inverse distance squared involved. For a compact source, we also have a redshift factor if, in fact, the radius of the photosphere is close to the surface of the star. So a measurement of the Eddington flux and a measurement at late times of the so-called normalization, where the star is behaving just like a cooling source with a fixed radius, basically gives us an angular area. And both of these quantities are dependent on mass and radius. And so if we have knowledge of the distance to the source, we can then infer the mass and radius separately. This is a model-dependent situation because it depends on whether or not we include certain systematic effects, such as the validity of the Eddington formula in a non-spherical environment, the question of where the position of the photosphere is, and depending on assumptions, we can get results similar to what Ozell et al. Have established for the mass and radius regions of these four different sources, or if we relax some of those assumptions, we get somewhat larger error regions. However, they are all consistent with relatively small radii. And when we combine this information with that from thermal sources, we can make some first steps into understanding the equation of state at high densities. So using a Bayesian analysis on four of these thermal neutron star sources and on four different radius expansion burst sources, Steiner and myself and Prakash and Danny Paj have basically concluded that the 1 and 2 sigma limits to the pressure-energy density relation implied by those measurements are shown by this particular curve, and that translates into an overall mass-radius relation that looks something like this. One interesting result is that the prediction is that the maximum mass implied by this mass-radius relation should be greater than 2 solar masses. It also implies that the symmetry energy of matter is relatively soft, and when we parameterize the symmetry energy by a volume symmetry coefficient and by a density dependence of that, we find that the preferred values of this density dependence of the power is of the potential part is around 0.3, which is on the low side of nuclear models for that, and that accounts for the relatively small radius. So when we put the resulting equation of state back in the overall equation of state diagram that I referred to earlier, we get this for 1 sigma limits on the pressure as a function of baryon density, we get this pink region here. And at high densities, it's overall consistent with the results from heavy ion collisions established by Danielovich, Lacey, and Lynch. And at low densities, it's consistent with neutron matter results, the Hiebler-Schwenk results, which are shown here. These will be discussed a little bit later. And there's an overlap then at the lower density. So the last two points I want to make are shown on this slide and the next slide. It's obvious that if we measured the radius of a 1.4 solar mass star, this would have to imply a maximum value for the maximum mass. And that's because of causality. So you can see from these particular curves, which are different extrapolations of the equation of state to high densities, that if, in fact, we could measure the radius for here, for example, as at 1.4 solar masses, for this particular case, say, a little bit over 9 kilometers, that any equation of state that has a mass radius diagram that passes through this point, there's obviously a limit to how much mass can be put onto that particular star before the equation of state becomes a causal or before the maximum mass point is reached. So this is a preliminary result, but this is a suggested value of the maximum mass that's implied by a particular radius of a 1.4 solar mass star. So if a 1.4 solar mass star had a radius established for it, this would imply a upper limit to the maximum mass. So for a 12-kilometer radius, that would imply a maximum mass that it would have to be smaller than about 2.3 solar masses, for example. So the measurement of radii does give information about the maximum masses of neutron stars. And the final point I want to make is what I began with earlier, was this the result that neutron matter studies, which tell us about the symmetry energy and its derivative, are related to the so-called symmetry energy coefficient, which is the second derivative of the nuclear of the energy with respect to the proton fraction at the saturation density, and its derivative, which is commonly referred to as L in the liquid droplet formalism. And but one must not confuse one set of parameters with the other. However, with a particular nuclear interaction, we can build models of nuclei, change how the symmetry energy coefficients in that nuclear interaction vary, and establish what the correlation is, and then also compute the properties of neutron matter, and then compare with the neutron matter results. And there are two particular groups, Carlson et al. And Hiebler and Schwenk, that have been focusing on neutron matter results. So it's interesting to see how these two different correlations, which have completely different physical mechanisms, so they shouldn't give us the same correlation, since there'll be different correlations where the two correlations cross, should then be the answer of what the symmetry energy coefficients actually are. So together with my student Yin Wan, we've been making Thomas Fermi finite range using a Myers and Zwiatecki finite range model and looking at the relationship between the derivative of the volume coefficient and the volume coefficient. So the correlation between these coefficients is shown here. So these are basically contours of the best fits to the overall nuclear binding energies. And so this dashed line shows that correlation. On the other hand, the results from the neutron matter studies of Hiebler and Schwenk are shown by this dashed curve. And the two asterisk points are the results of Carlson et al. And the interesting point here is that the dashed correlation curve and the dashed correlation curve from fitting nuclei seems to indicate a crossing point at around a symmetry energy of 32, and a ratio of the derivative of the symmetry energy, the logarithmic derivative, and the value itself of around 0.5 or 0.55, something like that. On the other hand, the Carlson et al. Results are somewhat stiffer, and it doesn't appear that these two correlation lines are actually going to cross at all. So there's still some model dependence that has to be worked out here, but I think this is an interesting thing to explore, and we might want to have some more discussions of this during this meeting, that this might be an interesting way of determining these coefficients purely from nuclear studies and working in the astrophysics as an afterthought.